Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Today on CityCast Denver. Are the Monforts planning to demolish one of Denver's most historic jazz clubs? Producer Paul Caroli and I are talking about the future of El Chapultepec, plus Landlord Watch, Algorithm Edition, and your comments on the Broadway bike lane. Today is Wednesday, March 13th. I'm Bree Davies, and here's what Denver's talking about. Hey, Paul.
Hey, good morning, Bree.
Good morning. I don't know. I like to think that this is breaking news to someone like me, but we were going to talk about something else, and then this story appeared this morning.
Yeah, Business Den reports on El Chapultepec, the new fate of the building that's been closed for 2 years since being a historic jazz bar for decades and decades in downtown Denver.
Well, they really cut to the chase. In the headline, Thomas Goenlie says, Monfort's third project on market calls for demo of El Chapultepec building. So
this is the owners of the Rockies. We knew they had bought this building a couple years ago. There was talk about them maybe saving it in some form, but now this new plan, yeah.
Yeah.
What does this mean to you, Bree?
I mean, it's like developers be developing. Mm-hmm. There's that side of it, which is like, am I surprised? Absolutely not. You bought a decrepit old bar in the middle of probably some of the most high-priced real estate in the city, and you're going to preserve it as a decrepit old bar? I don't.
Yeah.
I never bought that. But then there was the 87 Foundation's involvement, and we talked to Stephen Brackett about utilizing the space to be this transitory, you know, in the middle, before the as the Monforts, quote, figured out what they were going to do with it. Stefan was, they've been hosting shows there. They've been trying to sort of make it a nightlife space, I think, to experiment with this idea of changing Denver's nightlife to be more inclusive to more people, which is admirable in its own right. However, I don't think that that actually has anything to do with the real estate part of this conversation.
Yeah, no, I mean, for the Monforts, it's pretty clear what they want. I mean, their new plan, they say it calls for a covered patio on that corner just across from Coors Field. And I think Dierks Bentley's whiskey house is right next door. I mean, this is Party Central in Lodo.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're looking at what's actually happening in View House is across the street from there. They're seeing what has been happening on this corner of I guess the ballpark neighborhood for 20 years now, because this was before, was it Soil Dove or something? There was something else across the street that I used to go to and drink a giant adult Slurpee called a 180 Octane on the rooftop of that place 20 years ago. And it seems to still be similarly doing that kind of stuff. And I would say El Chapultepec probably fit in there a little bit more 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. But it's become less and less relevant to what's happening. Not less and less relevant to the jazz community, less and less relevant to the neighborhood around it. And yeah. It seemed strange that the Monforts would want to buy that and keep it. You know?
Well, this is clearly not their first plan. Like, I think I remember talking to Stephen Brackett when we went down there to see the inside. And he was like, they had some other plan that would have maybe required some like redevelopment of the space and then the one next door. But I guess that didn't work out. I don't know. I mean, this is what they're currently working on. Here's the last thing I want to ask you about this, Bree, before we move on to our regularly scheduled programming.
Sure.
Quote from the Business Den article, but there's already been pushback to the Monfort's new plan. On Monday evening, Monfort, this is Kenneth Monfort, said he was told by the preservation-minded nonprofit Historic Denver that they would lead a push to name the structure a city landmark, effectively preventing demolition. A city official confirmed that an application had been submitted already.
Yes. I guess I'm not surprised. What I am surprised about by this statement is This feels a little bit more aggressive than historic Denver has been in the past decade. So I'm making a lot of, this is my grand guess, Paul.
Give me your theory.
So my theory is Annie Levinsky was running historic Denver for like a decade before, and she's now at History Colorado. She's been there for a couple years, but I do feel like when she was running this preservation stuff, she was a little bit more pragmatic in the conversations. It didn't ever seem like historic Denver was taking a firm stance. In fact, I always felt that they were trying to present options for preservation without taking a firm stance. And this statement to me sounds very different from that era of the historic Denver approach. So this probably will be a fight, and I can see it happening. And of course, I have personal attachments to this place. It's a epicenter of one of our greatest historical pieces of like what makes Denver Denver is our jazz scene for sure. And so I can see folks fighting for it. My question is just, what is the relevancy of this space in 2024 in the middle of Bar Central, right? There would be the argument that like, we don't have to give up everything to these forces, right? This was, we were here first, that kind of thing. I see that side. I also see like, I don't know, man, I kind of saw through the Montforts. Like from the beginning, I just didn't buy it that they were not going to develop into something that looks similar to everything around it. A sports bar.
Yeah. They saw opportunity here. And like preservation is a big ask. Like, because someone's got to pay to keep it in good condition and make it the landmark that you want it to be.
Yeah. And I can't imagine they looked at that building and didn't think it's going to need a ton of work. They had to know that. There was a family running it for decades. You know, it was a dive bar. Dive bars aren't known for being like this beautifully structurally sound places. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I would just say, my heart is in one place. The realistic nature of this situation is in another place. So.
And a lot of people out there love the Peck. So we'll definitely be talking more about that one. Let's get to our news of the day. We're back with another edition of Landlord Watch, our semi-regular look at the folks fighting the good fight to provide housing in this housing crisis, or the absolute scum of the earth, depending on your perspective on landlords. So our first story here is about this new bill, which there hasn't been a ton of reporting about yet, but it's at the state lawmakers are working on it, and it has to do with algorithmic rent setting. Bree, can you explain this bill?
Yeah, so the way the software works is, like I said, there hasn't been a lot of reporting on it here, but these algorithms have been looked into in other states. And so ProPublica says, quote, to arrive at a recommended rent, the software deploys an algorithm, a set of mathematical rules, to analyze a trove of data that has been gathered from clients, including private information on what nearby competitors charge. So landlords can buy access to this algorithm and see what everyone around them is charging. And I think what legislators' point is this is eliminating the competition aspect and making it more difficult for renters to negotiate. Right. And that's sort of what ProPublica points out is they say, quote, for tenants, the system upends the practice of negotiating with apartment building staff. This software discourages bargaining with renters and has even recommended that landlords in some cases accept lower occupancy rates in order to raise rents and make more money.
So the issue seems to be competition to me. That it's about not allowing renters to have options to go find a better price somewhere else because these other buildings are likely or perhaps using the same algorithm service, this YieldStar program. That's fascinating. That kind of explains this quote from the bill, this that they're banning that says the landlords may or may not employ or rely upon an algorithmic device that uses, incorporates, or was trained with non-public competitor data.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the ProPublica investigation is that these companies, these large landlord real estate companies, were all willingly sharing their data with each other, but that wasn't necessarily data that was made available to the public.
Yeah, the sharing data thing, that's one piece of that. That seems certainly anti-competitive. But I don't know if this is like, I don't know if what they're doing is like banning the algorithm itself. It sounds like under this bill that these companies could still use a hypothetical algorithmic device as long as it relies on or is trained by public competitor data. presumably scraped off of the internet, off Zillow or something.
I think this is something we could ask the legislators, because we're literally relying on one paragraph of a bill summary here that I don't think is super clear. I know Representative Javier Mabry has been involved with this bill. Senator Julie Gonzalez has been involved. So I would be curious to see, because it's still in process. That's the other thing, is we don't know what the end of the bill is going to look like. But I will say there was this other quote that really struck me about how... Well, ProPublica says one of the algorithms developers told ProPublica that leasing agents had, quote, too much empathy compared to computer generated pricing, which just made me feel like that seems so dirty.
Yeah. I mean, too much empathy relative to what?
Right.
Like,
what's the empathy scale here?
Like, are we humans first or are we profit makers first? That's such an interesting quote.
Well, and I also just want to point out one more thing is a company that we have talked about on this show before, Graystar, which is actually the largest property management firm in the country. I did not know mm-hmm. that is one of the companies that employs this software. And they have found that it helps them in markets even where things are not competitive. They've been able to continue to raise their rents. Graystar was known because that tenant brought a lawsuit against them for junk fees.
Right, so. The class action suit back in January. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have also been preparing to talk about Graystar because they are behind the Landlord Watch story that I was planning to discuss today. So maybe we just segue right into that.
Yes.
How funny that it's the same landlord. So I'm actually waiting for a call back from Graystar. Maybe I'll ask them what they think about this this algorithm bill at the State House. But yeah, I mean, the specific building that I wanted to talk about was 2300 Welton Street. Do you know this? The Welton Park Apartments.
Let me look it's
right on Welton, right on the light rail line. It's kind of one of these like newish, I think some people would call it like a cookie cutter-ish look, yep. You know, the Denver Fugly style. It's one of those buildings. However you refer to that, it's one of those. Mm-hmm. But last week I started seeing posts on X from Ayanta Anderson, the former school board vice president who was most recently running for State House District 8, but then just dropped out to found this Center for Advancing Black Excellence in Education. This obviously has nothing to do with education. So he's still civically engaged.
He's still connected
in
the community, for sure. People are probably sending him like help. You're a person who has a voice. Please help me.
Oh, yeah. Maybe some of the residents of this exact building, because he posted last week, help needed. The residents of Welton Park Apartments have been without water for 6 consecutive days. This was posted on March 9th. This is inhumane, and we demand better for these residents, many of whom are low income. This is a building that has both market rate and affordable units. He says residents have been forced to use portable restrooms, showers, and limited access to a garden hose from a neighboring building. Can you imagine that? Going down out of your apartment to shower with a garden hose at a neighboring building, or like waiting in line to do so, because there's almost 200 units in this building.
In a building that was built in 2016, also, no less.
I know, it's not even 10 years old. How is this happening?
It's that's one of the most striking things to me, and I think is the struggle that a lot of folks have here in Denver is we have a lot of new buildings, but some of them are not, they're obviously not in great shape. That building's less than a decade old, and That's wild. That's so not great.
Yeah, seems like a rush job or something going on.
Something
I don't know. Nine News did some reporting on this. They say the tenants were notified about a pipe burst on shortly after the water went off. But you know, it was as of late Saturday evening that they got cold water back. I still don't know if they have hot water back. It might not be there as of our recording here on Tuesday, March 12th. But Ayanta Anderson and a few other local leaders were out this weekend. They had a big press conference calling attention to this.
I just cannot imagine having to live for that many days without water access in my God knows what I'm paying for apartment.
Yeah. Oof. Oh, actually, here is a statement from Graystar to Nine News. They say, unfortunately, the repairs to the broken pipe took longer than anticipated. We have communicated with residents that there will be a rent concession applied to their April rent. We understand the inconvenience this has caused, and while it wasn't the ideal situation, we did bring in portable bathrooms with showers, made vacant units available, delivered drinking water, and provided meals. The Denver Water Department tested the water today and communicated that the water is safe to drink.
Mm.
So.
Hmm. Well, I would be curious what those rent concessions are and how people who live in that building are feeling about the things that Greystar says that they're offering. Landlord Watch Hotline, always open, 720-500-5418. If you have direct experience with this situation, we'd love to hear from you. But this hotline is always open. Landlord Watch is ongoing. So you can give us a call and leave us a voicemail or a text message. Again, that number is 720-500-5418. Let's take a quick break, Paul. And when we come back, listener comments and questions. And we're back. We always love to hear from you, our wonderful listeners and readers. We've got a voicemail from Andy.
Hi, CityCast. My name's Andy. I'm calling from City Park West. I'm kind of late to the bicycle, conversation, but I just really want to emphasize, I think Paul's right that the Broadway bike lane as is right now it's not complete. It's not fair to call it complete, but it is a step forward. To me, I think it's always going to be wrong to say, well, when they do this bike lane, then the network is better. That's what it's about making a better network. Myself, I'll say that this actually helps me in a specific way. Like, I like to order from Time Monkey Club whenever we do like a work meeting. Sometimes at work we do kind of after regular hours meetings, and I have to bike from the Golden Triangle down to Time Monkey Club on South Broadway to pick it up. And the previous set of bike route that I had to do was just crazy. I had to go down to, through Loma Lincoln Park and down Galapagos and then back over to Broadway. The side streets were just not a good option. I also think I might have been one of the only people that ever benefited from the old Broadway bike lane. I used to work at the Starbucks at Virginia on Broadway, and I would open in the mornings, and then I would like bike up the street to go to the Illegal Pete's and get a breakfast burrito at Illegal Pete's, just north of Alameda. And I would do that all the time, and no one else ever rode in the bike lane while I was biking, at that time in the morning. This was back in like 2019, because it just wasn't very useful. It didn't go very far. So I think this is a much more useful bike lane now, but it will be much more useful when they extend it further down to Englewood or up to downtown or just keep going. Thanks very much for the conversation, and bye.
Thanks, Andy.
Oh my gosh. I resonated with so much of that. But Paul, he was kind of speaking to you about this conversation about the network. What did you think?
Yeah, I think he's exactly right. I think we agree totally. I mean, the Broadway bike lane, it's not complete. It doesn't go as far as those of us who use it would like it to go. And the connections between these big, beautiful bike lanes that were built mostly under the Hancock administration, our former mayor, that's kind of always been the problem, is like we have some really beautiful ones, but they don't connect to each other very well to provide a lot of options. But just specifically, like, I totally agree. Going through La Alma Lincoln Park and that Santa Fe area, that is really gnarly. I can see how the Broadway bike lane would provide a better option, especially if it was extended all the way to downtown. But yeah, Kalamath, Santa Fe Drive, those are like, that whole area is not fun to bike around.
And he made me think a little differently too, when I think one of the criticisms was like, why on Broadway? Why not one block over or two blocks over on Grant or something? And he made me think differently in that, like, this is a thoroughfare for cars because it's the easiest way to get somewhere. So maybe this is the best option for bicycles too, just because the way the city's laid out, that's going to be the fastest way. And it's just more safer now because there's a bike lane. So I kind of am thinking about it a little differently now, though I would agree with him. I actually go to that Starbucks on Virginia and Broadway fairly often. And I sit at that light forever. It's waiting for the turn lane and then the bike thing to go, and I've nary seen a bicycle ever in it at any time of the day. But that doesn't mean they don't exist, and I think he makes a good point, just as we've had this conversation over and over again, as the network expands, more people use it. So
yeah,
great perspective.
Yeah. All right, shall we move on to a text message This one's from Milo. Hey, CityCast crew. After Friday's episode regarding the Sobo bike lane, sounds like a lot of these are about bike lanes, which I love, about the Sobo bike lane, I wanted to provide some insight as a neighbor in Baker. Hey, fantastic. Thanks for writing in, Milo.
Yeah.
As much as I can understand the frustration of many non-cyclists towards seemingly lack of improvement along Broadway, I can attest as a daily user, this has been a major safety upgrade for my commute. Fantastic. Prior to the bike lane's construction, that side of the street had no barricades, and often the far left lane would be interpreted as, quote, extra parking. Resulting in cars parking on top of the proper lanes of traffic and more commonly causing bike lane users to swerve into active traffic to avoid double parked door dashers. Boy, biking on Broadway before the bike lane, Milo is right. That was like, you take your life into your hands. Although sometimes that's fun, though, as a biker, like I think some bikers don't actually acknowledge this, but there is a part of it. There's like you tap into your rebellious spirit. You start like swerving between cars that are stuck in bumper to bumper traffic. But you're like, oh, I'm getting ahead. I'm getting there faster. I'm doing this my way.
It's definitely a hubris off between cars and cyclists sometimes. And I'm not talking about the dangerous aspect. I'm talking about that thing you're talking about in that moment. Like, I'm going to get there faster.
Yeah. Milo goes on. Although the ongoing construction seemed to amplify people's free-for-all approach to finding a parking spot, since this final upgrade, I think it really promotes the usage of the bike lane, as I have seen a significant increase in folks utilizing the more protected lane. The only downside I can observe is that I agree it kind of stops randomly after the Blue Bonnet. Not that a lot of foot traffic makes it down much further than that, but it would make far more sense to establish a full connection down to the I-25 Spaghetti Monster. Ever in love with your work?
Oh, Milo, that's great. I love these first-person accounts, honestly. I think this is one of the most helpful ways to understand the effectiveness of something like a bike lane is hearing from people that use it every day.
Yeah. And just on the point of like, is the Broadway bike lane complete or not? I did look this up that the city has plans to extend it further north to Civic Center. They just don't have the funding in place.
I also have to say too, the parking situation was really confusing. And I do think that this added a little bit of order to it. I also don't have a problem as a driver parking outside of the, I like being the protection between the bike lane and the traffic. That doesn't bother me at all. In fact, I think it's good design. So
yeah, I think that's ideal.
I do too. Okay, we have one more text about bikes, our ever popular topic, from Brandon M. in Cap Hill. He says, the comment from Friday's show about bikers having extra cash to spend at businesses cracked me up. I chose to sell my car when I moved to Denver and bike bus everywhere. And yeah, it's definitely cheaper. But for me, the trade-off was needing to live closer to where I work in Uptown, so I figured I could pay more in rent without a car payment or high parking space fees. I have never thought, oh, quote, I can splurge on drinks or dinner because I didn't drive here. Y'all are right. A lot of assumptions are made. That said, I'm excited about the new Broadway bike lanes because it will be easier to get around here, go out to dinner, bar hop, whatever, especially in the summer. It was previously very scary to bike around there because even if you're trying to get to a calmer road like Sherman, you might still have to bike on Broadway for a block or two. Thanks, Paul and Bree, for always covering the bike lane drama. Love the show. Thank you, Brandon.
Oh, you know it. There's bike lane drama. I want to be in the middle of it.
I just love, yeah. Thanks for sharing your experiences with us. I love these perspectives. So fun.
I have one other thing to say about this, because this question of like, does the bike lane support business? Like, do bikers bring more money, more expensive income that they can spend at these businesses along the bike lane? We were undecided on this, I think, when in this show that everyone's responding to. But I did read a story, thanks to Allison Torvik, who flagged this on X. There was a story on Business Insider recently about like looking into the studies, basically, of do bike lanes help businesses that are adjacent to them or not?
Sure.
And according to the writer of this, they looked into like 32 research articles. They analyzed some specific situations in different cities, but they say bike lanes tend to help businesses. That's the conclusion from this this article that I'll post a link to in the show notes.
Yeah, I'd be curious to read that because I'm still with Brandon on this. That is a stretch to me.
The main point was like, it's about accessibility. Like you want anyone, depending on any different type of transportation to be able to come to your business, and that business owners tend to overemphasize how many people come to their businesses in cars. Like statistically, they've showed that with surveys.
I could see this being a pedestrian thing too, and less a bike thing in that I think about sometimes you're in a neighborhood in Denver and it's so pedestrian and accessible that you end up driving from one place to another and it's only like a 3-minute drive. So it would have been a 10-minute walk, but it's too precarious to walk. So you do end up driving. So I could see that definitely being like, you might keep people in a neighborhood and keep them shopping or utilizing more services along a block if it was just safer for people in general outside of cars.
Yeah, I think it plays into the density argument for the same reasons. Like just more people who feel safer moving around the street means more business.
I definitely like thinking about that. That's really interesting. Well, that was fun. I love that people love our bike lane drama updates. Because we enjoy talking about it as much, I think, as you guys like us covering it, because it's just a part of this conversation in this city as it grows. And so keep the comments coming. We really appreciate it. Paul, thanks for joining me.
See you next time, Bree.
That's all for today here on CityCast Denver. If you enjoyed this show, why not take a minute to tell Kenneth Monfort about us? Rate the show wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to our morning newsletter and learn more about us at denver.citycast.fm. We'll be back tomorrow morning with more news from around the city. Bye-bye.